Ezra 3, this is about the dedication of the temple after Ezra and some of the exiles have returned, and they dedicate it, but there's mixed response. The old men who had seen the first house, they wept, verse 12, but others shouted for joy. Why this difference in response? I think the difference was because those who shouted for joy were just happy that, well, we've got a temple of some sort, we've got some sort of religious system, and we can offer our sacrifices, etc. But others wept. I think those who had seen the first temple, they realized this is nothing compared to that first temple. But I think there was another reason why some wept, and it's this. They had been commanded in Ezekiel 40-48 to build a temple system and to operate according to the commandments given there. And that clearly had not been done. Don't forget, Ezra is sometime after the first exiles have returned. They had a huge number of prophecies of restoration behind them, whereby they could have returned, rebuilt a temple with all of God's blessings behind them. They could have restored his kingdom. They could have become the praise of the whole land around them. And God's kingdom could have been, to some extent, re-established, including with some messianic figure that Ezekiel calls the Prince, and which the restoration prophecies call the Branch. And Zerubbabel means branch from Babylon, so I guess he could have been an initial fulfillment of it. And I think those who wept, I think I would have wept if I were there, because I just see that, sure, they did have some religious devotion, but all they were trying to do was to get back to what once had been. When, in fact, they'd broken the old covenant. This was quite clear. They were told this multiple times, and Zechariah takes a stick and breaks it and says, look, this symbolizes the breaking of the covenant. And so God had offered them in Ezekiel 20 and in Jeremiah a new covenant, a new deal, where he would write his laws in their hearts. And that new deal involved building the temple, as explained in Ezekiel 40-48. It's called there the law of the house. And if they were repentant, then they would be allowed to build it. And yet they did not obey what is written there in Ezekiel 40-48. That whole setup that you've got at the end of Ezekiel is not, it is not the law of Moses. That is very shoddy Bible reading to think, ah, yeah, the law of Moses was to be restored. No. You look at all the commands about how to rebuild things and how they were to operate. No, this is not the law of Moses. This is a different system that they were offered. But instead, they seek by all means to go back to the old and familiar. They kept the Feast of Tabernacles, we read in verse 4, and in verse 1 we're told that this was at the seventh month, which is when the Feast of Tabernacles was to be kept. They kept it as it is written. They offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the ordinance. They were very careful to do this. Verse 5, afterwards the continual burnt offering, offerings of the new moons, etc. They were going back to the law, when in fact they had been told not to do that. They couldn't. That old system was finished, and they were offered this new covenant, where God would give them his Spirit. And it is that new covenant, in essence, which we have accepted. We've accepted the gift of the Spirit in our hearts, and we commemorate that by taking the cup of the new covenant, the New Testament, when we break bread. Well, it was so near, but so far. I mean, verse 2, Jeshua stood up with his brothers the priests, and they built the altar. They rose up, or they stood up. And this is quite a common phrase used in Ezra and Nehemiah for how at different points they rose up, or they stood up, and did things for God. And it's the word used in Isaiah 51, 52, 61, Arise, stand up, Jerusalem. This was to be the arising of Zion's glory. And yet they simply arose, and instead they built an attempted copy of the Law of Moses and an attempted copy of Solomon's temple. And they did this, verse 3, in spite of their fear because of the peoples of the surrounding lands. We can read that positively, that, well, they did it despite their fear. And yet you can read it negatively, because throughout Isaiah's restoration prophecies tell Judah, do not fear. Do not fear. Yahweh is with you. You're going to restore the kingdom. Well, take Isaiah 51. I, even I, am he that comforts you. Who are you that you should be afraid of a man that shall die, and of the son of man that shall be made as grass, and forget Yahweh your maker, who stretched forth the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth? The idea is, the God who laid the foundations of the earth is going to lay the foundations of the temple if you let him work through you, so don't fear. But they did fear. And they offered all these things, we are told, even though the foundations of the temple had not been laid. Well, God says he is going to lay the foundation of it. You see verse 11. They sang to one another in praising and giving thanks to Yahweh. All the people shouted with a great shout, because the foundations of the house of Yahweh had been laid. But no, they'd laid the foundations only then. They were offering, it seems, on a makeshift altar that was okay in the right place, but it was only now that they laid the foundations. But they're trying to do all this without the foundations having been laid. Whereas God says, don't fear, I who laid the foundations of the earth can lay the foundations of Zion. Well, yes, but they just tried desperately to push through keeping the old covenant, which is ended. They don't want to accept the new deal. When it says in verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month they began to offer offerings to Yahweh, but the foundation of Yahweh's temple was not yet laid. Well, yeah, they make all this dedication and then they do lay the foundation stone. Don't forget, this is 70 years after the decree of Cyrus for them to go back and build, and giving them everything they needed. And yet in that time they had not even laid a foundation stone for rebuilding the temple. Well, it was a very, very pitifully slow response. Really it was. And, okay, you read about the priests in their clothing with the trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise Yahweh according to the directions of David, king of Israel. Sounds good, but the system of praise that David had set up was only very poorly replicated. When you look at the list of the Levites who returned in Ezra 2, you find that the famous singing families of Heman and Jeduthun, they didn't return. So they couldn't have exactly kept it as David had laid down. In fact, Ezra 2:41 says that only 128 people from the singing family of Asaph returned, and that includes women and children. So it would not have been that impressive, really, because, well, they weren't really achieving it. You see, but when they shout, when they do finally lay a foundation stone in verse 11, this was supposed to be the situation in Zechariah 4, verse 7, when shouts would be made, when the foundation would be laid and the glory of God would descend, etc. Well, that didn't happen. It's the same with, as I say, in Ezekiel 40 to 48, at the end of it, Yahweh is there. The cherubim of glory that had left the temple at the beginning of Ezekiel would return, but there's no evidence that that ever happened. So, God says in Zechariah 8 that he would come and live in the rebuilt Zion. And that's why, as I say, the name of that city from that day was to be Yahweh is there, in Ezekiel 48, that God was to be there. The picture of Zechariah is that The old men are going to be rejoicing in the streets of Jerusalem and while the young children are playing. But instead here the old men weep, because this is absolutely nothing compared to what it used to be, let alone to what God had said it could be and should be in Ezekiel 40-48. Well, I think you see here, yet again, wasted potential. This is one of the greatest themes of the exile, wasted potential. It really is, wasted potential. You look at your own life. It's not that you didn't do anything for God and you didn't respond at all, just like they did respond, but not ideally. You know, you met a guy who was really interested in the gospel and, you know, he had a whole bunch of people who he knew in his little town who were also interested. And so he said, well, come down Friday nights and teach them. So you go a couple of times, but, well, Friday night, well, you've been working all week. I need a break. I don't want to drive 2 hours each way to see these guys and teach them. Maybe you could just go along to some local congregation and learn the gospel from them. You keep going, but just now and again. Oh, maybe someone else can do it. Oh, I'll ask Johnny to do it. Well, Johnny didn't do it. And, well, it slips away. And so that didn't happen. Those people could have come to the gospel, but they didn't. And it's your fault. And so it is in life. It doesn't mean God will give up with you. You may, for example, in this totally hypothetical case, the brother might keep on going to the meetings. Yeah, keep on going. He's not become an atheist. But there was so much possible. And you see, if he had gone and preached to those people, and yeah, got them all baptized, well, then the middle-aged lady who was baptized, you know what? She has a daughter who lives actually around the corner from you. And, she's a stunner. And she's such a great woman. And she's so spiritually minded. And, she was just waiting for the gospel. Oh, yeah, she gets baptized. You could marry her and go forth and do great things together. And she actually, the family are actually from, I don't know, Timbuktu. And she's got a whole load of family and friends there. She starts preaching to them. Oh, let's go out and see them, honey. Yeah, you go out there. You become missionaries there. You have your children there. You build a church there. One thing leads to another. But if on Friday nights back in your home country, I can't be bothered. I just need to unwind at the end of the week. I'm going to go down to pub with the guys I work with. I mean, it's not a sin, is it? No, but you see, the whole path that was set up for you didn't really work. And maybe while you're down a pub with your mates, well, your mate's sister comes and she's not a believer at all. And, well, you rather like her, rather fancy her, get a bit of chemistry, get married, and she's like, well, you know, I'm not a religious woman. And you're like, okay, yeah, so be it. And there you are, different values, you drift away. And, you know, that's what happens. And you see it happening all the time. And, you know, this is what was in essence happening here. Wasted potential. Because people could not put their own agenda, secondly. You know, Haggai says, why is my temple waste? Well, because you want to dwell in your own cedar-paneled houses. And by the way, where'd they get the cedar from? To have cedar-paneled houses while the house of God was desolate. And Haggai says, well, go and cut some trees down then and get the timber to build the Lord's house. One minute, verse 7 here in Ezra 3. They gave money to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the sea to Joppa, according to the grant that they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. So they got all the cedar trees, as many as they needed, for the temple, but, woo. Strangely enough, they ended up, the people living in cedar-paneled houses, while the temple of God was waste, and there was no timber to do the work. And Haggai says, well, go up the hill and cut some trees down then. You won't use cedar then, but just use wood. But just do something. What happened to the cedar that Cyrus arranged for them? Oh, they nicked it, didn't they? They nicked it. They used it for their own houses. So, you see, this positive picture that you got here is, I'm afraid, not so positive when you probe a little bit beneath the surface.